Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, social critic, and mentor. Navigating the messy art of living and the complex beauty of relationships through these conversations that we need to have, but we often shy away from. It's another Tuesday and time for an appointment with the Reluctant Therapist. And hi, Elizabeth, where are we going to today?
Today, I had a different topic in mind. So I had something else that I was working on, and we will get to it.
Okay.
It had to do with, the idea was, what if we're wrong? And it was kind of based on this very long article about ADHD and the long kind of complicated history we have with diagnosis and treatment and not really understanding the route of ADHD or how it really presents itself. It's a really complex issue because the researchers and clinicians are divided about how to go about treating ADHD and why do we have so many young people that are diagnosed. And now we have this, you know, huge trend of adults being diagnosed. That's kind of where I was intending to go today. That's what I had planned. And it'll drop into the topic a little bit today. But as I was getting ready to leave to come in today, I got a phone call from my dad, my 87-year-old dad, and I could hear in the background all these bells and whistles and sirens going off. And I said, "What's going on?" And he said, "Well, all of a sudden my iPad started having all these bells and whistles and alerts coming up, and I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do. It says that, you know, I need to call this number because I'm in violation of something." Literally a gigantic scam that really concerned my dad, obviously, because it looked so official and he didn't really know how to respond. And it hit this place in me that is so deep, because it's not just I didn't even get to solve the issue with my dad, unfortunately. I was able to walk him through hard, you know, closing his iPad, which he really enjoys, you know, looking at his pictures on that and reading articles. And, you know, to have this kind of terrifying alert come on that sounds like, you know, everything in his bank account is going to be drained. It's unconscionable, you know, that we have a culture, a society that's educated and wealthy and has access to resources and just blatantly can scam and harm elders on a regular basis. Because my dad's not the only one. We read about them all the time and we get warnings and, you know, warnings for children of their, you know, older adults to help them navigate this. But, you know, we should not be living in a society where we have to alert our parents or keep them safe from predators that are just waiting at the door all the time. You know, predator is real and virtual and made up. It just really put a pall in my afternoon. But then as I was driving, you know, thinking about it, I said, you know, this actually is not isolated. It's actually part of a bigger piece of the story of what goes on in our culture. And it kind of builds off of what we talked about last week about, you know, who are we as Americans and do we have any sort of cultural story? Because I was thinking also about the first day of school yesterday and meeting with my students and going over the assignments for the quarter. And one of the assignments that I have them do, I challenge them to get rid of their social media for the entire quarter. And then I smile and say, "If you can do it for a week, I'd be okay. But ideally, you can do it for the quarter." But also understanding that much of your life is now connected to those contacts and connections and apps that you use on your phone. Like, I understand where we are right now. I'm not ignorant to that. But as I was going through the resources, I said, you know, part of this assignment is to help you be more aware of how you're spending your time in your life, to be more aware of who you're handing over all of your information and your time too. And so we have this assignment because these are all budding clinicians, people who are thinking about going into the helping professions. And part of the reason I give them this assignment is that if the clinicians themselves cannot step outside of society and look in at it with a critical eye, then they're not going to be able to help anyone. Because much of what bogs us down or creates mental health issues is being so immersed in a cultural story you can't see your way out. And so for a lot of young people, teenagers, 20-somethings, and I would argue people our age as well, have been so seduced by the algorithms and the addictive nature of being on social media that they don't see any alternative for how to live their lives now. It's just, it's become all-encompassing. And so I asked my students who want to be clinicians, hey, if you take time out of this, stop living this social construct and be more of a witness to how people are living their day. 80-hour work weeks and spending time video gaming for hours on end and, you know, however people are spending their time that has become very uniformed and accepted, you need to be able to step out and look as a witness and see how is our lifestyle impacting our mental health and well-being. Because unfortunately, many clinicians are so wrapped up and caught up in the social narrative that they can't help anyone else because they also are captured and captive of these habits that do not serve our mental health and well-being. So as I was going through the resources, I was actually stunned a little bit and very disappointed when I realized that of my 36 students in this class, only two had heard or read any of them. Jonathan Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation, that came out last year, that talks about just the lost generation to social media and phones and screen time. Only two of the students had ever heard of his book or his research. Shocking. They hadn't watched The Social Dilemma, which if you haven't, you should watch yourself on Netflix. It came out during COVID, which seems so foundational that how could anyone, you know, continue to participate in our social story the way we do after watching that movie? And then I asked them if they'd watched the documentary series Social Studies that came out on Hulu last year that was all about their age group. It's a documentary that follows a group of teenagers in Los Angeles for the course of a year, and they had access, the documentarians, to the students' cell phones and how they interacted with each other and how they use social media. It's so raw that I couldn't imagine that these young 20-somethings wouldn't have watched this because it's their age group. None of them had seen it. And then, of course, the TED Talks about, you know, the algorithms and the addictive nature of it. They had none of that information. And so it became very apparent. It's like, well, of course they're not questioning their behaviors or, you know, their use of social media or their time they're spent video gaming because they aren't learning the negative aspects. They'll hear about it. You know, there'll be a meme or something that comes up on Instagram or Reddit, wherever they get their info, that says, hey, this might be harmful for your mental health. Mm-hmm. But they're not actually seeing this documented information that shows how awful it is. And so that was really upsetting to me, thinking about these teenagers who have unfettered, unregulated access to social media, and no one is regulating or wanting to step in or make sure they have enough information to be able to proceed with caution and care, to utilize the tool as a tool and not just have it overtake their life. And so as I was thinking of those things, the experience with my dad and teenagers, and then this idea of, you know, medicating young children for ADHD as early as 3 and 4 years old, but even 6 or 12, I mean, before they've gone through puberty, before their bodies have even developed, before their brains have developed, how can we as a society think that that's okay, especially when there is so much doubt into the efficacy, you know, of ADHD medications, of Ritalin and Adderall? I mean, some of the research that's come out recently shows that, yeah, it works great for about 14 months, but then after that, it's not effective. But you have children that are on these medications for 18 years or longer when they stop being effective. So now their little bodies are just addicted to the substance. So here's where my question is for the day. Who is responsible for protecting the vulnerable in our society? Who do you think is supposed to be looking out for us? Because I imagine we present ourselves as a benevolent society. I think we like to think we are, that we look out for our neighbors, who want to care for each other. Although after, you know, last week's conversation, I don't know if we really are those people, because looking evidenced by, you know, what I experienced this week, I feel more and more like we're a everyone's out for themselves society, that you really, if you have an opportunity to make a buck off of somebody's vulnerability, then there you go. Make a buck off of their vulnerability. If you can sell someone, you know, something that they don't need, but they were dumb enough to buy it, then that's capitalism. That's who we are. We're all about progress. That doesn't feel like who I want to be or what kind of society I want to be a part of. But here's the dilemma in this conundrum that I find myself in. Because I want to have a society that's committed to caring for the elderly so that my parents can live in their home and feel safe and they're not going to get some, you know, malware on their computer or have to worry about being scammed out of their money or buying, you know, medical services that they don't need. I don't want a country or a civilization that makes it dangerous to become old. I also don't want to live in a society that makes it difficult to be a teenager or a child, that you're vulnerable to whatever the decisions are of parents who may be uninformed or clinicians that may be uninformed, that no one steps in and teaches teenagers about the harmful effects of social media and the harmful effects of spending hours and hours on video games. It might be tossed off like, hey, it's not good for you. But I want to be part of something where there are actual grown-ups who step in and say, no, we don't do that. And here is what we do. And here is the way you can live that's healthy and good for you. To have some sort of plan and some sort of guardrails and some sort of grown-ups, but it doesn't feel like we have that at all. And here's why. Because we live in a free and open society. And that's, I guess, what we really signed on for. If we say we're Americans, it's about free and open society, and no one is going to regulate or tell me how to live or where I'm going to live or how I'm going to raise my children or how there's like nothing is going to regulate me. And so that sounds fabulous, but I think there are unintended consequences that I'm not sure don't outweigh this idea that everyone's in it for themselves. I'm going to get what I want and I'm going to go for what I want. And it's all about my joy and pleasure and bliss. And everyone else, you know, can do their own thing. When it's just this giant, chaotic free for all, I don't know if the unintended consequences don't outweigh that. Because how many unhoused people do we have all over this country? And our reticence to step in and say, hey, we need to care for these people because we don't want to step on anyone's toes. Some people are just down on their luck. Some people do have mental health issues. Some people have drug and alcohol issues. And because we don't want to step on anyone's toes, we have this giant unregulated problem where we make little tiny, we're so excited when 7 people get housed into something. That's not a win. That's a drop in the bucket. But we don't want anyone to feel offended. And what about children in the foster care system? Who protects them? Because if you look at the statistics of how many times children in the foster care system are picked up and moved from house to house to house from the time they're first removed from their family home, is that really in their best interest? You know, why wouldn't we create some sort of well-run home for foster children that's supported by the state or the city or the county, that they all live together and no one has to move? And all of a sudden, everyone gets all nervous. Oh, my God, that's an orphanage and bad things happen. Like, can we revisit these institutions or these ways of protecting the most vulnerable that doesn't always have to devolve into something that is nefarious or about mistreatment, the way we think of orphanages or the way we think about institutionalizing the mentally ill? We opened up all the institutions and sent people thousands and thousands into the streets, and things have not improved. They've just gotten better. So maybe we need to revisit institutionalized care and mandated care. But I don't know if we have the stomach for that. I just know that I don't have the stomach for being in a position where I worry about my parents and people harming them just to get a buck out of them, where I worry about my college students because no one has given them any information to help them make better decisions about the way they use their time. I don't want to have to worry every time I pass someone who I know is struggling and living on the streets and feeling like, who's responsible for this? Because what we're doing doesn't work. There's got to be something better. And so that's what's on my mind today. I want to talk about that. What are your feelings? I mean, is the free and open society worth all the unintended consequences? Can we create guardrails or some sort of protective orders for the most vulnerable in our society? Or is that just impossible? Like, why don't we care enough to step on people's personal rights for the betterment of the greater good? So there's where I'm at. I can't wait to hear where you're at. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. You can also be part of the conversation after the show by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, or you can find me on Facebook or Instagram and leave a message there, which is a whole nother story because, again, the way I'm feeling about all of our unregulated and unfettered access to social media, I think those two things have to go away from my life because they are not serving, but that's another show. But for this time being, you can still send me a message through Instagram and Facebook. And also you can listen to previous shows, listen to last week's show that kind of led a little bit into this week's show by visiting kcbx.org and under our News Talk tab. Or you can podcast our show wherever it is you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR Podcasts. Look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and then you can listen at your convenience.
Whew. That's a lot.
I feel I'm a little worn out.
I am too, just listening to you.
We're going to take a quick break and catch our breath, and we're going to come back, open up the phone lines, and hear what you have to say right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Nothing really is, but things that stay the same, they have to change again. Hello. Change your name, but not the way you play pretend. American Requiem. The big ideas, yeah, are buried here, yeah.
A lot of talking going on while I sing my song. Can you hear me? I said, do you hear me? Look at that, look at that now. Look at that, look at that.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Week two with Beyonce's American Requiem, because...
if it fits.
If it fits, hear it. I mean, it definitely has been on my mind week two of this topic. I don't know. I'm curious. Our number is 805-781-3875. The floor is yours. So I know we have a guest here with us today.
Yeah, from the band Brass Mash is our good friend Colin, who's actually training today and observing. And I'm kind of showing him the ropes just in case I need to take a day off. And I want to make sure I leave him leave you in good hands.
I appreciate that.
So hopefully we're going to do that. And Colin's joining us here. He's on mic two.
Absolutely. I hope to learn all the right buttons to press.
And the ones not to.
Yes. Exactly. That's what I was going to say. We're going to be careful with where we go with that. So usually, you know, no one is better equipped to make a cultural observation than someone who plays in the Brass Mash. So if you have any thoughts.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad I brought my opinions with me today.
I mean, that's I didn't come in, you know, loaded with a lot of statistics today, just a lot of feelings. Today is a very feelings-based show. I don't know if you have parents that you look after or kids that you look after, but how do you both feel about this idea of, you know, because I keep the term nanny state keeps going to my head. This, you know, we are so reticent and worried about becoming a country where there's someone, you know, overseeing everything that we do as individuals. I understand that. But man, do we leave a lot of people really vulnerable and fending for themselves.
We sure do. And I think your comment about the homeless is a great place to start. I mean, we're leaving generations of people with mental illness on the side of the road when, for better or worse, at one time there was a place that they could at least receive some level of care and somewhere to be, because that's where they needed to be. And I think a lot of this stems from the decisions to close those institutions down many, many years ago, and we're still getting the repercussions of them to this day.
And just interesting with the timing, because of course the, you know, current governmental powers have announced today that they want to start putting into mandated housing and placement for those who are unhoused. And so all of a sudden, this starts to become a political and divisive conversation more than a humanistic conversation. Mm. You know, what's in the best interest of the humans are involved. I'm afraid that right now with this proposal, it's going to become, how do we fight against anything that comes from the other side of the aisle? Because if it comes from the other side of the aisle, it must be nefarious and it must be, you know, have bad intentions. And so then that just becomes a whole nother layer of harm to the most vulnerable people who don't have a say and who don't have access to the resources they need. And in all honesty, from the mental health profession, we don't have all of the resources. And if you sat in a conversation with a group of mental health professionals, which I have and do often, the quiet conversation we have is we can't help the most severely mentally ill. We can't. We don't have the tools. We don't really know what drives severe mental illness or chronic mental illness. And to have some sort of institutionalized safe care would really be important, because to put this giant task on mental health professionals is not getting us anywhere, and it's straining a system that's not set up to care for that level of challenge for people who are struggling, and not just mental health issues, but, you know, drug and alcohol addiction, just addictions in general, you know, to have opportunities for people to get treatment. And if they don't want treatment, to have a safe place to engage in their addiction. You know, I have often thought that if we were closing military bases and maybe we create safe spaces for people who are in their addiction to go and to get access to clean needles or whatever they need. And if they decide that they want out of that, to have treatment available. Okay, I think about how we create these safe spaces, almost like playpens and play yards that we do for children, you know, who are vulnerable. How do we create those spaces that you're not really impeding on someone's life and saying, you can't do this? But instead you're saying, if you're going to do this, here is the place that you will. And when I was in high school, and it's such a long story about having a crush on a boy, but when I was in high school, I ended up at Agnew State Mental Hospital volunteering on the weekends. And we would take the patients, the residents, to church. And it was very overwhelming as a high schooler to go do that. Because the people that were there quite often presented as being just fine and would talk to you as if it was my grandma talking to me. And I remember feeling that kind of conflicted experience of, well, what, they're just fine. Why are they here? And then, of course, the backstory in my head was, what if someone decides that I'm not okay and they put me here and I can't get myself out? And so I can understand both sides of the story of, one, let's have a place where people can be safe and cared for. And on the other hand, who determines who goes to this place? And then what happens if we overstep that? And then it goes back to that whole why we get nowhere, because there's always a yeah, but to every offered solution.
Those two words, the yeah, but argument or what about argument, I think are the arguments that hold us back in that regard. The other thing that we haven't touched on yet is how much our prison and jail systems have been overrun with dealing with mental illness versus housing people who truly need to be behind bars. Mm-hmm. Because of the pressures on that system, we've had to release people out into the public that have done more harm than any of them. And I think that's a discussion that we have to come back around to, because there are two sides of that, the people who really want more law and order and the people who say, well, we need to have meaningful law and order in prison reform.
Restorative justice.
Right.
Because remember, you're talking to someone whose daughter is a public defender, a public defense attorney. So I can hear her, screaming at you right now, and which also makes the conversation so challenging. So I want to, that's why I kind of wanted to back up and stick with, we can go anywhere. I'm open. And again, our phone number is 805-781-3875. Would love to hear from you and your thoughts. I'm sure you have many. 805-781-3875. But the thing that's just grinding away at me are the three areas. Elder protections. My parents have the right to live on their own. They've paid their way. They have their home. They've done their duty in the world. No one should be going after them. No one should be able to go after them for a cheap buck. It's, to me, the most questionable part of our free and open economic system, capitalistic system, where if you can drain a dollar out of someone, and it's not new. I mean, just think of snake oil salesmen on the back of their wagons, in the 1800s selling, mystical potions. There's always been someone who's can grift and con money out of people. But it shouldn't be acceptable to us that our elders should ever be in danger. Who's going to step in and protect them? Then number two, for children, for young children, we have to have more limitations to the access to medications or who's medicating children under the age of 15. I'm trying to, at least to get into puberty, because medicating children before they go into puberty, we have no idea how we've messed up their entire development and where that takes them. But we have very few guardrails on that. And again, my ADHD conversation is kind of on the table, but maybe more later to give more information. But how are children diagnosed with ADHD? There's not a blood test that determines. It's an observational test that quite often is done by a well-meaning elementary school teacher who may or may not have the maturity or experience to deal with unruly children, but doing the best they can in a difficult situation. So they fill out an observation sheet, which then goes to a primary care physician or a pediatrician who looks through the same, observational sheet. And then we have the diagnostic statistical manual that has, the nine precursors to determining someone who has ADHD. But again, depending on what time of day you're observing this child, did they get a full night's sleep? Did they eat breakfast before they came? Have they had lunch? Did they get a chance to run around the track? Right? How is the child presenting at the time that these observational diagnoses are being made? And from that, you can have a child's whole future determined by one prescription that is written for them. And again, can't blame the parents because they're following the protocol. And then at the same time, in the back of my head, I'm going, oh my goodness, I don't want to step onto the other side of some divisive political, conversation that's happening that's demonizing all sorts of medications. And so I'm not sure what the answer is, but I do know that we need to, I would hope, as a society, want to create, I don't know what it takes. I keep thinking of, remember were they called the angels that walked around New York City back in the 1980s, then were...
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the specific name, but it was Curtis Sliwa's organization. Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And they came under fire in some ways, but they were there protecting common citizens so that helping old ladies cross the road and making sure people didn't get pickpocketed and get taken advantage of. Like, maybe we have to have some benevolent order that looks out for, knocks on the door at my parents' house and goes, how's it going today? And make sure that my parents have what they need. And maybe it is my job and I should move up there and, you know, live next door to them. I don't know. I'm throwing it out to the public to decide.
It's so difficult to say because, you know, speaking about ADHD mm-hmm. diagnoses, I've seen it in my own family. My youngest son, when he was small, very energetic boy when he was, you know, lots of energy. They wanted to put him on ADHD medication early on, and my wife said, there's no way that you're going to do that because he hasn't grown enough that we know what his personality is going to be about. Yeah. And I think to her credit for putting her foot down, yeah, he's still the personality that he is, but he's grown into it and recognizes that he's got some of this kind of stuff going for him, and he's learning to live with that and without having to rely on medications, which may have they might work great for some people, but may also have unintended consequences elsewhere. Then I've also seen other instances where, again, a well-meaning person tells somebody, I think that because of what I observed that your child may not fit into a standard educational setting and needs to be kept back for a few years, mm-hmm. mainly just because maybe they didn't have the skills, as you say, to be able to effectively teach this child, and that's what they relied on as their fallback position. And their parents, what do they know? They're going to do what they think a professional is suggesting for them.
I know.
Those are lifelong things to happen, mm-hmm. right?
Well, yes. And again, the whole question of how old should children be when they start school? Boys actually do better if they start a year later than girls do. Maybe, you know, shouldn't be starting school till they're 6 or 7 years old. So they kind of, I mean, there's so many pieces to it. But then kind of the essence of all of it is that we're a free and open society and everybody's just kind of told, make your best decisions that you can, which I feel is disingenuous when there are actually some better decisions than others, and that we're so afraid to step in and make that call for fear of stepping on someone's toes. I don't have any stats in front of me, but I'm curious to know how many people actually are harmed by our unwillingness to be a little more heavy-handed. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and our number is 805-781-3875. The topic of conversation is, who is responsible for protecting the vulnerable in our society? How can we commit, or should we commit, to being a society that looks after each other, or are we just allowing ourselves to be so free and open that everyone is responsible solely for themselves? Love to have you be part of this conversation, 805-781-3875. We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Although, Not much of a conversation. Unless you're going to call and enjoy it. I was so excited about this topic today. I really thought, oh, no, this is something that people will be fired up about. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation. And as I mentioned earlier, we do have a guest in the studio, Colin, here. I guess you're getting trained to be a button pusher.
Yeah, exactly.
Professional button pusher.
Ever in case Brad needs to take a day off or something like that, or needs to visit the DMV.
Stand in line all day. So, I mean, you heard kind of the topic of the day, my frustration. Does any of that resonate with you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I worked as a teacher for 17 years, in our education system here on the Central Coast, as well as the Bay Area. And I really resonate with this topic. There's, who's in charge? Who's in charge around here? And especially working with the general public, mm-hmm. Working with the general public, you end up with a lot of folks who, have a lot of struggles in a lot of ways. And working with them as a teacher, you're working one-on-one with people, mm-hmm. and they might be having their best day. They might be having their worst day. They might be having their worst week, mm-hmm. or maybe even their worst year. And you're working with them and their kid and trying to work forward.
Did you have to do ADHD assessments?
Oh, no, we leave that up to the professionals. there would be definitely times where, I would get to visit individual plan that was made for a student. There would be meetings and so forth. And, so I would attend meetings and, contribute my thoughts towards things and observations. But, I was a trained musician, so I can have some very basic observations about what I see and how some kids compared to other kids, but really teachers just make a couple suggestions.
Do you feel like we should have more regulations in our society, or can be the free and open society that we are?
I think that the answer is always both, right? Mm-hmm. I think especially as we get into parent autonomy and how parents want to take care of their children. And I think we also need the supports at the same time. If you know anyone out there that works at the schools, that it's a black hole. There's always more to do, mm-hmm. and there's these kids need so much love and so much support. And, you think about if a kid, especially if kids in special education or has a 504 plan, boy, there's you could just keep on throwing resources at this kid. And this kid keeps, just absorbing those good things and they just need more. So it's like, how can we give enough? Well, at the same time, we also don't want to overdiagnose kids either. We don't want to give kids so much help that they become helpless. We want them to be able to thrive and be able to complete their own work as best they can.
Well, and I think that's, one of the challenges I'm seeing in our college kids that I've been, working with post COVID. It's a different, I've taught the millennials and now I'm on to the, Gen Zs, and I have grandchildren of the Alpha generation, and to see the fragility in many of the students, and I think a lot of it comes directly from our over-parenting. You said all parents want to be autonomous, but I really more and more feel like that if we know that there are better ways to do things that statistically and have research that support them, then we should be following them. I don't know if we can just let everyone wing it, because if our job as parents is to prepare children for the complexities and challenges of adulthood, then it's got to be a more strict, more rigorous type of parenting that these kids get, unless we want to then shift to a society that is more that nanny state and make sure that everybody has all the resources and soft landings that they could ever want. I mean, I don't think we can have it both ways.
Well, to be fair, the parents have been throwing some curveballs in the last few years. So I didn't see this COVID thing coming.
No,
absolutely not. And there wasn't a handbook for that.
But we've come out of it softer instead of stronger. And that's the problem. For me, that's the problem, is that we need to come out of COVID with more resilience and not more fragility. And that's where we're not serving the kids, is that we need to help them lean into their innate resilience. But that's just me. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. And you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Something you said earlier about, if it's a free and open society, is this, can it work? we could look around and see other countries that have very similar societies and very similar laws, much of the same laws. They're doing a lot better. They're doing some degree better, you know, Scandinavia, maybe even England or Ireland. So why aren't we looking at what's working and learning from what's not?
Would you have a concern about giving up your own personal freedoms, though?
It depends. I mean, there's always a degree of that in society. For, you know, you've got, like, I don't have the freedom to yell fire in a theater. So, yeah, there are certain freedoms I'm happy to give up to maintain some kind of order and equality and move in the right direction.
What is our responsibility as a culture to care for the elderly and kids in the foster care system or those who are unhoused?
Oh, my gosh. I think we absolutely have a responsibility as a society, and we're not meeting it. We're failing miserably.
Any ideas?
I don't know. Especially a tough one, you know. If seniors want to be autonomous, as they should, you know, as you and I plan to be, I assume. How do you protect from, you know, scam calls? And that's a tough one. That's not an easy.
Can I break in and give a suggestion? I think we enable organizations, governmental organizations like the CFPB, to have meaningful regulatory authority over people that are interfacing with our senior population. But unfortunately, what ends up happening is they get defunded because they threaten the wrong people. Right. And so they, you know, this is one of the reasons why this happens, because the door is left open to service another group and sacrificing our seniors by allowing this activity. That's just how I see it.
Yeah. Well, Gus, thank you for taking the time to call. I mean, obviously, it's a big topic and everyone feels a little reticent to make any, you know, bold statements. But I appreciate you taking the time to share yours.
It's huge. There's so much that needs to be tackled. It's a lot to it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Fiona, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Yeah, I'm commenting on what you brought up earlier with regards to this, like, safe use site, I guess. I'm a public defender, and so many of my clients commit relatively low-level crimes. A theft of $25, or, you know, maybe a first DUI with no criminal history, or trespass because they're camping somewhere where they shouldn't or didn't leave a parking lot fast enough. And the solution, it seems to be, for the courts is mandate treatment, mandate total abstinence and sobriety. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a ridiculous and unrealistic request for people who are deep in addiction or homeless. They're not going to show up to probation every day and do a UA just because the court tells them to. They're not going to suddenly be sober and be stable because the court told them to. And so then the alternative is that they go to jail, and then they're not getting treatment in jail. They're not getting stabilized in jail. So it's just, you know, really interesting, because I don't think that legal systems are willing to have the conversation about safe use or realistic responsible use until there comes a desire for abstinence or sobriety. And I find that really frustrating, that often my clients are faced with, you know, white knuckling some really horrible drug addiction that they're navigating while they're homeless or sitting in jail for some period of time. And then at this point, they usually don't have, you know, a support system or family or network around them. So, you know, it's sad to see people give up.
Does it seem like to you that, from your perspective working in the legal system, that we have a really punitive legal system and a much too free social system?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, that's hard to say, because I think I interact with laws that don't seem to indicate that we have a very free or understanding social system. I mean, the criminalization of someone for having their grass be too long in their yard because maybe they have a mobility issue and they aren't able to mow their lawn, or it's just not that important to them, but that's a crime. Like, that doesn't seem like a very free social system to me. I don't know.
I know, because I think that's part of the dilemma is, I mean, for me, how do we protect the elderly? How do we protect young children? How do we educate teenagers and, you know, the harms that we know of social media use without becoming too restrictive? And interesting in the light of having, from what you're saying, a really punitive legal system that doesn't make space for people to grow or change or have restorative experiences.
And there was some, you know, I will say, in my time in public defense, which isn't much, I've seen at least how Tennessee and Illinois and Washington State all do it. And some places here, I know the previous caller was talking about Europe, but some places here have some really cool options and some pre-charging. You know, if you agree to work with a social worker for 30 days, maybe just get an alcohol and drug evaluation, maybe just have the conversation, then we'll not charge you with this crime. I think rewarding the small steps that people take to be stabilized and the efforts that they're taking to reduce the harm they might be creating in society, but also to better themselves is important. But that's not uniform. You know, that's not happening where I live here in Washington State. That's not happening at all. But you'd think, given that Tennessee is relatively less interested in that from a social perspective, and Washington is, you know, quote unquote blue. So I think that there's a lot of places that are trying to do it right, but it is really hard to see that sort of, I guess, that safe use or more practical goals could.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your insights, Fiona. Thank you for taking the time to call in and sharing your wisdom.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
Have a good day. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. And there's multiple questions on the table. The first one was, who is responsible for protecting the vulnerable? And can we create any sort of regulations or safe havens or ways to institutionalize, to protect those who are most vulnerable without stripping our desire to be a free and open society? I don't know if it's possible. 805-781-3875. And Steve, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Well, thanks for having me.
I hear you're on the road.
Yep. You're one of the shows I listen to every Tuesday when I'm heading back to Ventura right now.
Well, thank you. Well, so what stood out for you? What's on your mind?
Well, I've been in the insurance profession for 39 years. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you know, some people's health plans, they have health coaches, you know, you could have mental health coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you're how to take care of the seniors, we're getting ready, we're fast forward, we're going to be in the AI is going to be all over us here in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, and then we have prisons throughout the whole state of California are being shut down. And so there's many locations and many cities where, you know, mentally ill could be taken care of differently rather than being on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think, and then when you talked about, you know, the whole COVID thing, you know, I'm a person, when I'm walking down the, you know, the street or the boardwalk, you know, I like to have eye contact, and it seems like, you know, no one knows how to have eye contact now.
Yeah.
I have a 9-year-old granddaughter that my daughter, her mom, my daughter, and her dad, you know, we're pretty firm is that when she's talking to us, we need eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, as a society, I think it, you know, it, I think we're over-medicated. I believe there's, you know, people are jumping to conclusions about this ADHD thing, because back in the 60s, what did they do?
Well, they had the kids run.
Right. The outdoor activity instead of being on an electrical device.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and I think you brought up AI, which is interesting, Steve, because I've been reading some studies about putting in their AI animals, like pets, in elder people's homes, and they can interact and talk to them. And there actually has been some interesting results of like reduction of loneliness and isolation by having this kind of AI companion for people who live on their own. And then they also have direct connection to social workers who can tap into the AI system and kind of hear, you know, and respond to the people who are on their own. So there, I see some technical things that can be done to help reduce isolation, although for me that wouldn't be ideal because I would rather have, I'm more of the communal living person. I wish we could come up with more just and holistic multi-generational living communities that would support, you know, single moms with children and elder people who are living alone. That's my ideal.
I understand.
Do you think it works?
Well, there's a lot of people out there
that are
not listening to your program.
Yeah, that's true.
That should be listening to the options and choices that we're talking about now, because I've read a lot of articles on AI and about loneliness and depression, anxiety, and all those things that come with someone that is not willing to go out in the world because they might be germaphobe or afraid of this or afraid of that. Oh, I don't want to see this person. I don't want to see that person. And they get in their heads instead of just going out and doing it.
Yeah. That is, and again, it goes back to the free and open society. We can't mandate people to be social, but then we do feel that it's our responsibility to care for them once they become more of a shut-in or agoraphobic. It's a tough one. Steve, I appreciate you listening to me on Tuesdays. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Have a great drive. That is a conundrum because we want to see, you know, if I talk to my students in class when they push back, it's Professor Barrett, but here's all the good things that are happening with technology, with the ability to diagnose people or, you know, use of AI and creating these companions that really do show that it reduces isolation or, you know, loneliness in people. And I see all of that and the apps that are on the phone to help people be calm when they're anxious. Like I see all of that. But I also think that they are shortcutting the more challenging solutions about societies is how do we become an integrated, supportive society and not find more ways to make it easier for people to be isolated. I mean, that feels like the direction we're going is here's all the ways that we're going to accommodate people who are socially isolated or struggling or, you know, not able to participate in a greater society instead of looking at how do we create a society that's more inclusive of all age groups and all people. I don't know. 805-781-3875 is our number. Marianne, you're on the air. Turn down your radio.
Participate in a greater society instead of looking at
Marianne, are you there?
Create a society that's more inclusive of all age groups and all people. I don't know.
I think Marianne's going to have to call us back. 805-781-3875.
Turn down your radio, Marianne.
Please do. And give us a call back.
So, big conversation today.
Yeah. So, you know, I was thinking about, again, I'm going back because the last thing that happened so I walked out the door was talking to my dad and don't like him to be frustrated or feel confused because he, you know, should get all the support he needs. And I also was thinking about not only our long history of scams, but also, you know, misleading advertisers. And at some point, the government had to step in and stop advertisers, you know, from advertising cigarettes or for giving information that was incorrect. And yet, if you watch any of the 24/7 news channels right now, you know, and for any period of time, you see targeted advertising right exactly to the most vulnerable of populations. They're all about medications, and or insurance or
reverse mortgages.
All think very targeted. And again, I'm not saying that they're all scams or that are not good for the people that are watching, but oh my goodness, You know, it is about a society that if we can find a way to make a buck off of people who are vulnerable and worried and, you know, wanting to make sure that everything's okay, those advertisements are really powerful. But now there's another step that's been proposed from the current government to stop all of the advertisements for medications, especially those that have to do with mental health. I 100% support that. We shouldn't be advertising medications for mental health treatments, because then people start self-diagnosing and showing up in their clinician's office and, you know, telling the clinician what it is that they have. And it just starts that slippery slope. I worry about especially the younger generation, because they've been so immersed in a culture that says mental health care is, you know, the greatest. Everyone should have, you know, a therapist that they're going to and some sort of diagnosis. I worry that we did such a good job reducing the stigma around mental health that it's almost become like a badge of honor to have some sort of disease or diagnosis or disability that kind of is the cornerstone of the badge that a lot of young people have. But the challenge with that, though, is, again, as I mentioned earlier, instead of building on resilience, what can I do? We have a lot, almost a whole generation is leaning into all the things they cannot do. You know, I'm too nervous to go outside. I can't go to a party. I can't take notes in class. I can't have loud noises. It's just so many guardrails around the things we can't do. I also think that that doesn't serve us as a society or a culture either, that if we're going to have a free and open society as we do, then that requires that we have resilient and, you know, self-aware and educated citizens who are able to make decisions and choices that are in their best interest and don't just fall prey to whatever the current fad or story of the moment is. And right now, the story is all about social media and how we're exchanging information. And in light of seeing all of the research that tells us and supports this fact that this information is not helpful, that it's harming our mental health, that it's creating biases and division, we still don't have ways to redirect the energy of people that are spending tons of time on social media, not just teenagers, but also older adults who have also gotten hooked in and locked into the algorithms that are very addictive. So, something to think about. We have to consider if we want to have mental health be more stable and grounded in our culture, what changes are we willing to make to improve access, safety, and regulations for those who are most vulnerable. Those are my thoughts for today. So thank you for tuning in. This has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast or show wherever it is you find your podcast. Go to Spotify, find A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and you can listen at your convenience. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com or send me a message through Instagram or Facebook. As always, I appreciate you tuning in and being part of the conversation and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.